highway, telling me to go where I.
All right, hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Light in the Attic podcast. We have a special treat today. This is our first ever label spotlight. We typically focus on sometimes other things, but we distribute about 150 labels at Light in the Attic. So for those listening, that means we work with like-minded people at other record labels and distribute their records to record stores around the globe. And so we thought we would shine a light on, that's a very bad pun, on one of our favorite labels, Mr. Bongo, who's based in Brighton, England. And they're actually in town here in Los Angeles and at the Light in the Attic office right now. And I'm sitting down with Dave and Graham from the label. And thanks for joining us.
Hey, man. How you doing?
Thanks for having us.
I'm doing well. Thanks for being here. It's kind of a number of questions here. But I guess first off, why are you guys in town?
Well, this is our third year now. We do a regular spot at Rap Cats where we set up a basic kind of pop-up shop. We play music. We do a little event there. And it's just kind of grown and grown, isn't it? It's been really successful at kind of introducing us to kind of the LA community and all the kind of DJs come down, J-Rock and Cut Chemist, and it's a great vibe.
It's put us in touch with a lot of the local heads that we didn't previously meet, and Dave's been fishing and digging in Brazil pretty hard for records that generally you can't find here, so there's that side of it. And then we bring the whole label catalogue and a lot of other selected bits and pieces from Europe that the distribution may or may not be here, but generally they're available for a little bit cheaper than you can get them. But the secondhand stuff is there's some pretty interesting stuff that comes out of Brazil and Africa, so yeah, I think that's there's a lot of big show pieces there as well, so it's good fun, man.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great pop-up Rap Cats.
It's amazing,
and the guests that they have, such as you guys as the curators, what do you want to say, is always insane, from DJ Shadow to whoever else.
And it's amazing, man. Yeah, the first one we did was a launch party for the Arthur Verikai reissue that we did.
Yep, that's
a great reissue. This year we're celebrating, having a Tim Meyer celebration on the Friday, Tim Meyer celebration on the Saturday, record sale on the Sunday. And last year we did which record did we do on Friday?
We did the Gal Costa
India.
Which has done really well for us. And just focusing on the kind of classic records, the Tim Meyer. It was a combination of a Tim Meyer album he did on Som Livre and his first 7-inch, which is kind of like a northern soul, kind of heavy soul break, where he doesn't look anything like Tim Meyer, but it's just a classic, and not many people know it. So it's, and people love Tim Meyer, man.
Yeah. I love Tim Meyer. I did not know that single until you guys reissued it, as much of your catalog has introduced me and a lot of
it's
people to things.
It's the first one he recorded when he came back from the US.
That's it.
So it's sung in English. And it's a very different vibe. It sounds like a soul record.
Yeah, it's a great northern soul.
It's amazing.
And I guess you had to start. What are you guys' maybe roles at Mr. Bongo? And maybe tell us a little history of the label and what you do there.
Yeah, so we're going to be 30 years next year. We started off in a little shop in Berwick Street Market in Soho, just peddling kind of Latin records that I was picking up. I was going to Venezuela and Colombia, and there's a big kind of Latin jazz scene, a salsa scene, and started doing that. And then the Brazilian music started to take off, so we started going to Brazil and bringing that back. And then we started doing hip-hop, kind of all the independence, kind of new wave that was in the 90s, all that kind of, Jurassic 5, all the stuff coming out of New York. And it just kind of grew from there. And then we got shop in Japan, we got a bigger shop in Soho, and then the label started in around about 95, and we just started doing Brazilian reissues really, and then started recording stuff, people like Terry Callier, Joyce, and then moved on. Now we're doing even reggae artists now like Protege, Holly Cook, and then doing albums with Ebo Taylor. Next year we've got albums with the Bedouin Sound Clash and the Skints, and so we're kind of varying it really. We like to kind of mix it up. We don't like to get stuck too much in one groove, but we are well known for the Brazilian groove, no doubt about that.
Yeah, there's definitely a thread that runs through all the music, and it's kind of roughly kind of roots world vibe. But we're branching out and doing some more projects next year, and we're looking to sign a lot of new acts as well to complement the reissue side of things.
It's nice that you guys have one foot in the past and one foot in the present. We typically mostly have one foot in the past. We want to have one foot in the present sometimes, but it's like a different type of animal.
The present is very difficult. It's expensive and it takes a lot of energy, but it's exciting. So it's almost like the reissues kind of pay for the new records, because sometimes the new records, they don't always make money. let's face it, setting in. It's really tough, and it's tough for new artists starting out, it's tough for new labels starting out. I mean, God forbid, if I was a label now, you know, year one, it'd be really tough to get going, you know, to just to get that income to kind of pay for the staff and whatever. But yeah, no, we like to have a balance. It kind of keeps exciting, really. I mean,
yeah, definitely. And working with artists, obviously touring and able to work very closely with us, and we work quite deeply into new strategies and ways to release, and we're always looking at, okay, how can we do things differently, which may not be that obvious from a lot of our output in terms of the reissues, but behind the scenes there's a lot of kind of new thinking going on there. So hopefully that'll start to become a bit more obvious over the next few years.
What was it like working with Terry Callier?
Oh, he's amazing. Kind of, he's such a passionate man. He was, when he first came to the UK, it was like the concerts were amazing. I mean, people would faint. He was just a vessel of light, and the whole place would light up. So it was just a real privilege. He was very, obviously, with like a lot of musicians, there's a kind of the real man, the guy on stage. But I just think everyone really warmed to him. And when he came up to America, sadly, he wasn't that well welcomed, and I guess a bit spoilt in America having so many great soul singers here. Mm-hmm. But you know, I mean, when we took him to Japan, there was a queue around the block. And just a lovely experience, a real pleasure, really. And he had a great kind of UK pickup band, which is for like Jim Mullen, who's a legend, and you know, just some great musicians he worked with.
He's still fairly unknown in the United States.
Yeah, he's crazy, man.
I mean, if you're like a record head,
yeah. I mean, he kind of dressed up a little bit hobo-ish. He'd have like loads of layers and loads of plastic bags, and you know, he'd go to like do a gig at, I don't know, the Blue Note or something in New York, and
right,
they wouldn't let him in the hotel. Wow. And I'd have to ring him up and say, "Here's my card," and all this stuff. And
it's crazy,
you know. And it's just that lack of respect. I mean, you see it all over the place. You see, like, you know, Kenny Drew playing a little crappy little bar in downtown, you know, and it's like, people don't always get the respect they deserve. And I think the grass is always green, isn't it? He comes to Europe, but it's traditionally, you know, like France and the UK have always been great kind of grounds for like musicians who just wanted to kind of improve their career. And whereas, you know, back in America, it's so competitive and not always that supportive sometimes, you know.
What about like working with Ebo Taylor? I mean, he seems like he's kind of
Ebo's another thing. Yeah, he's he's really like the kind of Ghanaian Fela Kuti, I suppose. He's much more kind of laid back and melodic, whereas Fela was really kind of drum, you know, really kind of funky, I suppose. And Ebo's got a more kind of melodic, laid back kind of Ghanaian kind of feel. But Ebo's been great. I mean, he got quite ill on the last record we did, but he kind of came back.
Wow, and sounds like Magnum PI or something.
Yeah. He's like he's able to create an amazing sound on stage with like five or six musicians, and it's very impressive. You know, songwriting. He wrote all the stuff for Pat Thomas, and you know, he's done a lot of records that no one even knows about. And he lives in this little town, Salt Pond, in the middle of Ghana. And he's a legend.
And the band that he works with, they're absolutely on fire every time. They're just, you know, they're one of those groups
Are they in Ghana or are they in the UK?
Yeah, they're all from Ghana. They come over. His son kind of leads the band now because Ebo's, you know, got a bit ill. So Ebo only sings like three or four songs because that's sometimes all he can manage. But they're great. I mean, there's two sons in the band. And when we recorded them in Amsterdam, yeah, everyone he brought over from Ghana was really on it.
Of your, I know this is kind of, this is probably an annoying question people ask of me sometimes, but I'd feel like it is actually fairly interesting. Of looking back over the last 29, 30 years, what are some of the kind of ones that were maybe more painstaking in terms of issues?
Oh, yeah, that's easy.
Okay.
Well, I suppose Prince Fatty, me and Mike. Mike's an amazing producer, but we had difficult times. I mean, you know, it happens. You know, it's a very intense business. There's money involved, there's a lot of energy, there's creativity, you're dealing with creative people. So with Sale George as well, we had difficulties, but we kind of resolved it most of the time. Mm-hmm. With Terry was just really easy and lovely. Joyce, for instance, lovely and easy. Ebo, very easy. But some people are more difficult, but hopefully they're worth it, you know. Cook has been fantastic.
What about ones that took the longest, or in terms of just even licensing nightmares, whatever else? I mean, you have projects that...
Yeah, there's some projects that took a long time. I'm trying to think.
Krishnanda took you, what?
Krishnanda, yeah, Pedro Santos.
10, 15 years?
Yeah, that was trying to get hold of Pedro's daughter and then go...
That's
to
a great record.
Agree to license with Sony.
Yeah.
Because we always try and license with the artist and with the label at the same time to try and avoid as many
complications.
As you know, licensing old records are not, you're never guaranteed a clean bill of health.
No, you're not. People have no idea on the how it is. But
the Verikai took a long time as well, didn't it?
Verikai took a while. I can't even remember why that was, but yeah, it just took a while to come together. I mean, Arthur luckily had kind of remixed and kind of remastered all the tracks, so they certainly sounded great, man. And that was a real pleasure.
That is such a good record.
Yeah,
it's probably my number one of all time. I think if I had to pick one.
In the catalogue or
everything really worldwide ever probably.
Yeah, well, Mad Libs probably in the same camp as you. I mean, I love it. It's just a perfect record. It's one of those ones as well that isn't that long, and that's what shows you like how you can balance a record on 35 minutes, whatever it is, just perfect.
Oh, it's beautiful.
You know, it's just
it's two and a half minute tracks.
So well conceived. Yeah,
it really is. Yeah, it really is. Tell us a little about the film company, because I honestly did not know about the film company until I was in Brighton this year, and you gave me the Orson Welles film. That was really great.
I suppose it came out of the fact that the music had gone down so much with the Napster kind of thing. I mean, if you remember, I don't know how long you guys have been going, but
we're not that. Oh, I remember the job. I had an internet related job in 1999. Right, okay.
So when Napster came in, pretty much it made music valued at zero, really. So all the young kids are just ripping it, and no one, you know, suddenly LPs, vinyl was starting to sell, the shops were all closing, and it was a bit of a nightmare situation. So I was looking at other things to do, and I was really into the Soy Cuba movie, I Am Cuba, which Scorsese and Coppola
kind of... I was going to bring that up.
Yeah,
that was
they kind of renewed that, as it were. They did some investment in it, and they did Saragossa Manuscript. So we licensed those kind of two films initially, and they did really well. We toured with David Bailey, Scorsese got involved in an interview.
Mm.
And it all kind of took off, and you know, in those days the sales were pretty good, the cinemas were very open to like art house films, so we did really well. So we probably had a good run for like 5 or 6 years of putting out Polish films, documentaries, you know, Russian silent movies,
Antonioni, and some really great directors.
No, it was real fun. I mean, and I was learning all the time. I mean, I'm no film expert, and it was just really interesting, really.
Soy Cuba or I Am Cuba is like one of my all time favorite films, so when I was saw you guys did it, it was amazing. I may have mentioned in Brighton, like one of the first projects I ever tried doing, Light in the Attic, about 2001, was trying to release that soundtrack for the first time.
Goodness.
You guys should totally put that out. Yeah. I was talking to the Cuban government or whatever it is, I can't remember, but it's the music on there is phenomenal.
It's that Platters track on there, singing the club, which is
unbelievable. I can't remember. I know the scene, which is just phenomenal.
That track, I still remember that track. I don't think it's ever come out.
It's a very powerful scene. It's a very powerful scene.
Every shot in that film is like a painting. I mean, it's just like it's.
Oh, when the guy, I can't remember the cinematographer. I think it's Justoisky or whatever his name is. I can't remember his name, but he used to work with Eisenstein as well. I think. Some of the classic old Russian films, and he would wake up in the morning and blindfold his eyes for like an hour, and then he'd put that box over his eyes so he could kind of get that screenshot, and then that would be the, and then he'd focus on that throughout the day, and you know, you get all those lovely shots, you know, those classic kind of cloud light trees, it's a spectacular film.
Yeah, that film is a masterpiece. Yeah. Put out the soundtrack.
I've tried before. I think I gave up.
So did I. But I think because you did the film, maybe they'd listen to
you. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It's complicated because the rights are divided between the Soviets and the Cubans. So all the territories are all divided up. And it's a
nightmare.
It's something that I think we've been talking about for a long time, is trying to make the two sides much more interlinked between the music and the film, but it just seems to be so difficult. I know Hourglass Sanatorium, and Andy Vattel did that.
That's right, he did, but
we'd love to be able to cross that over, but at the moment it's definitely something that we are planning to do. But
it's a struggle out. I mean, for us, we've only done in 200 plus releases, we've only done a few DVDs, and they tend to be part of some like box set or something where it's like,
again, no value.
I don't even know if people like,
it's gone the way of the CD. It's like gone to, like in England, like DVDs are $2-3, $4, and you just can't kind of like restore a film, and you know,
it's so hard. Seems like
you can't make it add up.
Criterion Collection can kind of hit it.
I don't know how they do it.
I don't know either. But they add all the bonus stuff for the first time. Yeah. But I don't know how they do it either.
We do exactly the opposite of them. We just do the film.
Yeah.
And sometimes if there's a good doc, we'll put it on.
Yeah.
But we just strip it right down. Right. We give you the film at a good price.
Yeah.
Good quality, not as good quality as they do, I admit it, but it's like, well, you just got to find your place.
They're not the Orson Welles one you gave me. I forget the name of the film. It was
pretty decent.
What was the film called?
Chimes at Midnight.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, that's a good one. But I mean, you know, it's like, I can't afford to do what they do. It's incredible. Yeah. I mean, you're talking millions of of dollars of investment in the film, and it's like that's way beyond.
I always feel like they're a big influence for us, and for someone to like, if we could be the Criterion Collection of music,
that would be good.
Which we have not hit good. That hat mark yet, but
it's just those prohibitive license deals. It feels like so it needs to move on. And the digital availability of a lot of those films.
Again, it's become zero rate in the sense that, you know, films have become something that people don't value very much as something they're willing to pay for.
Yep.
So it needs that kind of vinyl. I don't know how you do that. Because, I mean, obviously you have the steel box set and all this kind of stuff, but really it's not the same, you know.
The Blu-ray I was kind of hoping that the Blu-ray would take the place of the vinyl and the digital balance that there is out there for the music, but it hasn't really happened.
No, it doesn't seem like it for a very small few. How many releases do you guys
We did about 60. Year? We stopped quite a few years ago, really. We did a few Blu-rays now and again, but about 60 odd films.
And what about just the label wise, you know, how many records albums did you put out in a year?
Because we had a year. Yeah. God, that's like, a good question.
Like next year's going to be the busiest year ever.
I don't know. 20 albums a year?
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems way too
plus
much.
Plus 45s, plus 12s.
We try, and we sign way too many albums, really, for what we've got space. You're probably in the same kind of situation. Yes. You just can't fit them all in. And you want to. I mean, the great thing about what Graham does with his planning is like you maximise the kind of promotion on it, so it actually gets a real resonance around the world, so that people kind of, you know, although you might have one record by Bo Taylor, another label releases another record by Bo Taylor, you've actually got a record that's kind of heightened in its value, and because people are aware of it, you know, they've had some promo, and you know you've got PR guys around the world running it as well, so that really helps with what we do, because, you know, then a shop can like be more secure when they stock it that they will sell, and that's the key, really, I guess. Right. You know.
Those longer strategies on releases, basically, kind of, they, instead of giving you a quick hit, a couple of months running, you're talking about maybe 6 to 12 months on a release. Mm-hmm. So they last a lot longer, and we're working, as I said earlier on, into these kind of newer strategies and looking at how we can extend the lifespan of these records, which is, I think, especially important for new records, because otherwise they come and go so quickly.
Of course,
just drop them and it's gone.
But it even seems like reissues have kind of fallen into that somewhat, because it's such a gluttony of, there's so many labels,
too many records out there. Yeah, I mean, you look at the record. I mean, I look at our store in Brighton, and you basically got to have every record in that store, and it's kind of ridiculous. You know, people just haven't got the kind of money, and it has reached a kind of a swamped point, I think, now, where there's just too many. So that means you've got to up your game even more and deliver better quality and, you know, better records and all that stuff.
Yeah,
so,
production value, everything, the mastering, the source material, the card, the weight, the print, everything now is really just more and more and more focused on these specifics. And the audio quality is something that we're really trying to push. Obviously, again, source material varies, as you guys know.
Yeah,
the power of Zeus. Yeah, the power of Zeus reissue that we're about to do is that's from the tape vaults, Universal, 192K 24 transfer, cut at half speed at Abbey Road. So I don't think we can possibly get
that. And we kind of did that with a Verikai, but you can only get that if you got the sound quality that's of a good enough quality, you can cut half speed, or you can spend that kind of time on.
Yep.
But I think it's changed since the old days of just a reissue was just basically a dodgy scan of a record cover and a dodgy bit of vinyl. It's much. Everyone's up their game, and you know the customer out there wants the best. You know, they don't want to pay for those old,
which is a good thing. But there's just so much on the market. It's like, you know, there's so many TV shows now and everything else. And we're all having to listen to Donald Trump quite a bit. There's a lot of things.
And I think also music's so much easier to make now. So obviously, in terms of new artists, there are a lot of new artists because it's easy to make. But then, what's the quality? What's the plan? What's the kind of approach? What's the live act like?
You know? I think you guys, honestly have, kind of you're a step above in the fact that like everything you release, at least me, I honestly will say this, that it's just the quality is always there. If it's like the films or the new band or old stuff, and like the stuff that you've introduced me to as just a listener is like, it's just incredible. So it's like, I think that stands out. And some people, it's like they're just throwing out so much stuff, and it's like you just kind of have to find like your the older brother you can trust, who can take you to the record store and point out a few key things, and or sister, whoever it might be, and those things aren't always there, but when they are, you know, with you guys, it's there. What interesting question I had is like, what was you know, Lightning Act started about 01, like, what was the reissue game like in 89, 90, 91, 90?
That's a very good question. Like, well, yeah, I mean, when we did it, for instance, we did a Marcus Valley compilation. I know, so yeah. I know you've got some great records on your label as well. We did a Volume 1 and Volume 2. We brought him over to the Jazz Cafe for his first kind of gig in Europe for a long, long time. And they were like, you know, that was a CD only. No, we did some vinyl, actually. We did some vinyl, but it was like, that's how you did it. You didn't really, people didn't really want records like the original. They were quite happy with compilations, so you went down that route because it seemed to make sense. Whereas, obviously, now, people want, you know, as is, you bought in the shop in 1972.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, barcodes on the sticker on the outside. You strip the label off, and then suddenly you got the record as is, you know.
That was a big turning point for us, actually. And that was purely, as Dave said, there was a learning process through releasing, through listening to people. I think it was a guy in Brazil who bought the Piberian and said, why don't you take the barcode off and then it'll be the original. And we're like, ah, okay. So we'll try now, where possible, to make it absolutely, even if it has misprints.
Yeah, mistakes, yeah. The Piberian was the learning. Yeah, the Piberian, which is like the classic masterpiece of psychedelic rock from Brazil, this gatefold sleeve kind of crazy record recorded in the middle of the jungle in the Pernambuco because it was all under military dictatorship, so it was all very secretive. It was like, you know, it's the Holy Grail record for collectors in Brazil and Europe as well. And we just did it as an ordinary kind of gatefold. And then we realized that, you know, feedback from Brazil was, no, I need to actually just do it like the original, like, even though the C and D side are wrong and the dates are wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, both records have got different dates because it was all in a flood and one side was destroyed.
Yep.
So it's like, it was really interesting. We actually got three copies of the original at the Rap Cats, which is phenomenal.
Wow, that's nuts.
That's a hard record to get hold of.
Wow, did you find those on this recent trip to Brazil?
Oh, no, we paid a lot of money for those to various people around the world. Swaps and by hook or by crook kind of business. Yeah, I don't think you find those records on the street.
Yeah, yeah, that's incredible. Wow.
Yeah.
What other reissue labels were you, if any, were you guys fans of when you started or kind of in the game
think,
then?
I suppose the best reissue labels were in the 80s, you mean? 90s?
Yeah, early 90s, mid 90s.
God, that's 80s. That's a good question. I mean, there was this company out in Jersey called Scorpio who have ups and down rights to the records or not, but they were the only people doing reissues, you know, on a large scale. And, you know, initially they were the kind of source of most reissues, those guys. And then suddenly the Europeans woke up to it and started doing their reissues. So you got labels like, German labels like, Compostel started doing reissues.
Yeah, that,
and then French labels like Superfly started doing their things, which are fantastic because they introduced us to the, even though we had a shop in Japan, they were making records in Japan. On the sleeves and the obis, and we started doing that. Well, not so much the obis, but definitely the sleeves. Mm-hmm. Just perfect. Those lovely little, you know, those, what do you call it? Those, what's the Japanese style sleeve?
The tip on.
Yes.
But they're all like, you know, little old ladies in Japan. Got this image. Little old ladies. It's probably a machine, but it's a nice, quaint image of a little old lady sticking the back cover on.
Yeah. We're obsessed with the tip ons, but Stoughton does here in California is amazing, but then we're like, you know, we care. Does anyone else care? It's like one of those. It's like liner notes. Like for us, like liner notes are so important. Part of our releases. If we have, you know, if there's something we can,
we try and
someone interview. But it's
we don't always do it, but we try and do it, and it does add value. And I think sometimes, you wonder if it's like, is it the deciding factor in someone buying a record? But I just think it's like,
I think it's important just to the document of
the document,
like
it exactly. explaining it, and
people like, you know, you mentioned Marcus Valle, and you know, a lot of these artists, like, none of us are here forever, and it's, you know, they have stories to share, and I mean, there's great history to tell, and
he's an incredible, I mean, Marcus Valle in particular, I mean,
incredible.
He wrote so many great songs,
incredible,
like pop songs,
yeah,
and then all his own stuff as well. I mean, the guy's absolute legend. I mean, the fact that it's only the fact that he's alive, in a sense, that he's not bigger legend,
and he looks
than he would
like,
be.
And I haven't met him yet. Email with him.
He's got that young vibe. He always hangs out with young people.
He looks like he's like 50 in the photos. He's like in his early mid-70s.
He's the incredible kind of vibe. Yeah, he just keeps it together, man.
He never comes. He's rarely come out to LA.
Really?
Yeah, he does New York, like at Birdland, a bunch. But
he does Europe a load.
I bet.
I don't know why that is, though.
Well, it's just you guys get it so much more than Americans.
Yeah,
if it wasn't for you guys and the French, like, we wouldn't even know our own music. So thank you for that.
Thank you, French.
Yeah, to you and the rest of the British and French out there. But it is amazing. I mean, it's just the reality of, you know, the times have changed with the internet and things like that. But, you know, I mean, even just the reissue game of, like, you know, what, I mean, you know, Rhino, there's been reissues in America, obviously, Rhino for zillions of years and way before that. But, you know, a lot of the, you know, you guys, Soul Jazz, I mean,
Soul
really
Jazz
great,
always been good.
You know, really great labels over there.
And well, I mean, Soundwave,
the way Mars
is great.
The way Mars does things on Soundwave.
Yes, they're great.
It's an inspiration the way that those things are put together.
Yeah, there's all, we got loads of good labels in the UK.
Yeah, there's tons. There's tons. What do you guys have coming up, or what is maybe highlight a new release or something? I was thinking if it'd be cool with you guys, we could play a song for a new release
that'd
or
be
something.
Cool.
Most definitely.
Anything we got a bag wanna... here of goodies.
Oh, cool.
We can delve into
anything you want to point to. We could, you guys could highlight a track or something and talk about a new reissue.
There's a lot, man. I mean, this
that's a killer.
This is our Mariano CIA Sao Paulo album. Is one of my, again, it's one of my favorites. It's a Brazilian jazz fusion record, which is pretty heavy on the breaks. And it was, for me, it was, because I got into this game a little later than Dave, so I've been working with Dave for the last 15 years. My knowledge of Brazilian music prior to that wasn't amazing, but it was the records like the Arthur Verissai, like the Sao Paulo.
Mm-hmm.
This is our Mariana that really turned my head to into the Brazilian stuff. And that's one that has been on my list for a long, long time. Metropole, the intro track, really big break.
Mm.
I don't think it's been sampled as much as it should have done, really. And then the Futebol de Bar, which is the final track on the album. Again, this kind of big acid jazz days, and crossed over into the, it was getting plays in the kind of broken beat world in London, West London, and Carpet Plastic People when I first started going down there. So
right.
That's a really exciting one for me personally, which is due to drop next week, I think.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Any track you want to, should we play that first one?
Metropole, yeah.
That's heavy. Okay. That's heavy. Yeah, okay. That's a great one.
Yeah.
I mean, this is Tim Might, the height of his powers. I can't remember how many kilograms he was. He used to always put his kilogram weight on each album because it varied so much.
Right.
But yeah, you got tracks like Ain't Necessario, Now I Squinch Like a Bath. I mean, it's just...
For folks, Dave, maybe in a nutshell, for folks who don't know, tell us about Tim Maier.
So Tim Maier's basically, I guess, the kind of, I suppose, a Barry White, James Brown crossover, but I'm not doing him justice. I mean, like Graham said, he lived in America for quite a while, hence he sings in English pretty well, and he did these Racionale albums, which obviously they're the holy grail of Tim Maier. There's actually three of them, but he did two back in the days, And the rest, you know, was like a religious group, and they kind of all wore white. And Tim was a big kind of like, he joined the group, but also he was a big kind of ambassador, and he would sell the books of the Rationale, and the records were made especially to finance the group. Sadly, he found out the leader of Rationale wasn't as pure as he said, and he had a bit of a breakdown, Tim, but then he went on to make some more albums, and this was one of them after the Rationale series, and it's been a great seller for us, and it's kind of like a fusion of all his kind of like soul funk that he does, but also some of the slow stuff he does is really great, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you understand the lyrics, they're pretty crazy. There's a lot of drug references, you know, like you know, just weed and stuff. And yeah, he's a pretty funky kind of guy.
Digging for records as a teenager?
I used to come here, actually. This is the first place when I was 18. I used to come and stay with my friend Steve here and go to Record Surplus. Hmm. And then I was selling records to Soul to Soul to kind of pay for the whole trip. So Soul to Soul used to have, there's a big group in here, used to have a shop in Camden. And I used to go to like Record Surplus, come out with 50 boxes of Roy Ayres and all that when he just, you know, easy. And I'll buy him a buck a piece and then just fly over and I'd keep a load for myself to DJ and then, you know, so to there, and then I go to like the fair in Pasadena. Was it Saturday every month in the morning? And some real cranky guys, you know.
Well, it's a Rose Bowl flea market, and then there's a Pasadena Community College.
I think it was
PCC,
the same.
Probably.
I think it might be the same place. I don't know where it was. That was a long time ago. And then, then start digging there. Then over New York and Jersey, dig around there, and you know, that's kind of like, you know, it's a lot of digging in the old days. Huh?
So this is like mid '80s.
Early 80s, 84, 85. People are into like what's called rare groove in the UK, mm-hmm. which is kind of like the Fat Funk, the Voice of East Harlem, the JB stuff, you know, Tommy Stewart, these kind of records, really big records, and all the kind of, you know, Leroy Hudson, all these kind of things.
It's interesting what you were saying about the way that particularly kind of like, it's more obvious with the younger generations of guys who are buying our music that they probably wouldn't know any of that stuff. They know the modern soul records that Floating Points and Giles are playing, and they now have an incredible knowledge of almost top down, whereas it used to be bottom up when you say, okay, I need to get these standards.
That's it, you get the standards, then you go, oh, I'm, you know, I've got enough James Brown now, what about this Tommy Stewart record or whatever? And, you know, you just go, you go deeper from there rather than, I was always like, get my Al Greens in, my Nina Simone's in, my Marvin Gaye's before I even get,
of course,
before I do anything else.
Yeah.
You know, like,
but it's like the
Aretha, you know.
Essential.
Yeah.
The essential breaks and the foundations and things. Yeah. It's amazing that Floating Points is kind of an incredible playlist on Spotify. Floating Points, but there's numerous others on there, and it's just jams for days on there. Incredible stuff that you would you'd have no way of finding out what those records were back in the day.
A kid discovering music in 2018, a teenager versus a teenager in the 80s or 90s, it's a whole other
it's great experience. I mean, they're so lucky, and you know, like, and DJing, it's kind of pretty tough to come up with some other jams that no one's got, you know. Not easy.
No, and I think maybe that's kind of led to the, I definitely notice it in the UK and Europe, the standard of DJing now that we see through the guys. There's several guys who work in our shop, early 20s, and the standard of DJing, we're not talking about mixing records that are quantized, we're talking about mixing African disco records and boogie and things, and then these guys are seamless, man. It's scary.
It's
so not only have they got the knowledge, they've got the chops on the turntables, and
it's a whole other league.
I've hung up my headphones, man.
I'm thinking about it.
These kids are all over it.
Any plans for the 30 year anniversary thing?
Well, we're hoping to try and do a big concert in Brighton at the Dome. We're trying to work that out with hopefully Holly and the Skints and a few other bands, maybe Ebo Taylor. And then we're going to do a whole series of reissues based on the 30 years and We're going to do Carhartt t-shirts.
We've got some brand collaborations that we're working on. We've got what else is going on? We're going to do a pop-up store in Soho in London.
Yeah, kind of
back to our roots for a weekend. That'll be good.
Yeah, that should be fun. Yeah.
Hopefully, with some photography and some work into how we do that. But it's going to be an exhibition of what went on over the last 30 years. So that should be a lot of fun. We're going to do some things at Amsterdam Dance Event next year. They're already planned, hopefully, with the Rush Hour guys. Yeah. So that should be good.
We'll do WFMU as well. So that would be nice to do that in 30 years. We've never done a pop up kind of thing there. So hopefully.
We did it once or twice. It's worth going. I mean, it's an incredible record fair. Yeah. You'll love it. I mean, just being in New York, course. But you'll meet a lot of folks. And the only people who will know, obviously, you guys, but also for the first time discovering the stuff, that's really worth going to.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Just to see new stores and new customers over there and stuff.
Yeah. And I guess Rap Cats again, hopefully, next year. The big one. Not sure what the theme will be.
Guest show. Yeah, we'll get that going. And then we do Utrecht twice a year now, and that's a real big one for us.
I've always wanted to go to
that's
that.
It's absolutely insane.
It's like five football fields or something. It's like just like.
Yeah, I think you take a couple of weeks to see every stall there. Yeah. Wow. I mean, it's like we just set up there and basically we're just wholesaling. It's like there's just guys buying stuff and selling it, coming back an hour later, and it's just it's crazy, man.
When is that, first of all?
So that's like in November and April.
Okay.
So the key buying time in November, obviously everyone's filling up for their stores at Christmas. So look, that's the busy one. And then April's still pretty busy.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems to, it's been really good. I mean, I think it used to be just secondhand. You know, there wasn't any reissues. And now guys with little stores who used to do secondhand realize, well, we could sell reissues and that's easy to get. And they sell quickly and whatever. So it's kind of like there's been a nice kind of crossover there. We came in at the right time, I think. You can't get a stall anyway.
You bring like a semi-truck or what?
Last year we ran out of records after the first day. We had two pallets, and then we had to get a guy to drive over. This Polish fella drove a van overnight and got another couple of pallets, and they nearly all went. Now we're bringing 6-7 pallets this year.
Wow.
That's a lot of records, man.
That's a lot of records, man. They'll probably all sell.
It's insane. Megamania. Yeah.
Well, a big thanks for letting us distribute you guys.
Nice
it's
to
really,
meet you.
I mean,
yeah.
I'm a huge fan, and like, you're also very nice people. And I don't know, you guys just do phenomenal work, as I mentioned.
Thanks,
but
man.
It means
it's
a lot
to work
to be able
with you guys. Yeah,
well, thank
really
you.
Is, yeah.
It's mutual. How do maybe tell people how to find you on the web or all that kind of stuff?
All the usual social media outlets.
All right.
MrBongo.com for global. We also have, for people listening in the US, us.mrbongo.com. And if you want to buy things, we can ship from within the US there. So hopefully that'll make things easier. But yeah, MrBongo.com, search for Mr. Bongo on all the socials. Instagram's a big one for us. We like to push pictures of records through there, new and old. So hit us up there.
Instagram's great.
And we do stock a lot of Light in the Attic records, by the way. So
yes, you do.
We're a big customer.
Yes, lightintheattic.net is our website, so you can find Mr. Bongo in there, as well as many stores in the US and lots of other places. But thanks a lot. Good luck this weekend
at
Rap Cats.
Thank you.
And hope you can come down.
Yes, I have to sneak out of the house, but I'm working on that. So thanks again.
Cool, man.
Thanks for having us.
All right, take care.
Such a long way, I don't even know where I am. Such a long way, long, long way. I'm gonna sit right to where I am, and it's easier to stay here. Think I know my way here. I'm gonna lay here.